President Trump takes his tough talk on trade on the road to Asia.
We are not going to let the United States be taken advantage of anymore.
Competing tax bills in Congress. Who are the potential winners and losers?
You know, it's $500,000 in the House of Representatives, but the Senate, the deductions for mortgages go all the way up to $1 million.
And Democrats finally have something to cheer about, picking up some election night wins.
Not only did they win all these seats, but they also defeated a ton of Republican incumbents.
It's time to get caught up on what's happened and what's next. I'm Jared Halpern from Washington. If you try to keep up with President Trump's tweets, you've likely noticed they have come at more unusual intervals and times this week. That's because the president has been in Asia on a marathon, five-country trip focused on the North Korean threat and winning better trade deals. This trip included golf with the Prime Minister of Japan, a speech to South Korea's National Assembly, and a state dinner in China.
Today, I am here to offer a renewed partnership with America, to work together to strengthen the bonds of friendship and commerce between all of the nations of the Indo-Pacific.
In Da Nang, a dateline well-remembered by Americans who lived through the Vietnam War era, the president gave a speech at the Asian-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, a policy-driven address laying out his goals on new trade deals.
From this day forward, we will compete on a fair and equal basis. We are not going to let the United States be taken advantage of anymore.
In many ways, the message returned to promises first made on the campaign trail, the president telling Asian economic leaders he will put America first, the same way he expects them to put their countries first.
While we lowered market barriers, other countries didn't open their markets to us.
Earlier in the week in Beijing, President Trump told his Chinese counterpart, President Xi, he did not blame him for a trade imbalance. Rather, President Trump blames the presidents who came before him.
I do blame past administrations for allowing this out-of-control trade deficit to take place and to grow. We have to fix this because it just doesn't work for our great American companies. And it doesn't work for our great American workers.
Many of the countries represented at the APEC summit joined the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a 12-nation trade pact negotiated by the Obama administration and abandoned once President Trump took office. At the summit, the 11 other nations who were part of the TPP say they have agreed on some core elements and will continue negotiating a multilateral trade deal with or without the United States. Japan views the Pacific Partnership trade bloc as a counterweight to China's economic influence. President Trump prefers bilateral deals, even if those too need to be renegotiated. He is leaning, however, on several leaders in the region to help in the North Korean nuclear program.
The future of this region and its beautiful people must not be held hostage to a dictator's twisted fantasies of violent conquest.
President Trump continues to say Chinese President Xi can help solve the North Korean nuclear standoff. That was a big part of the talks those two leaders had in Beijing. The Commerce Department also announced what are called deliverables during the China leg of the trip. Secretary Wilbur Ross signing $250 billion in deals between private U.S. businesses and Chinese entities. Along for part of President Trump's trip was our White House correspondent John Decker, who spent most of this week in Seoul, South Korea, focusing on the president's message about the North and how citizens in the South are handling the heightened war rhetoric. Before catching his flight back home, John and I connected on Skype. So the highlight of this trip, in many respects, John, has been the president's attempts to try and find some new partners, some new ideas to rein in North Korea's nuclear program. What can you tell us about what the president was able to accomplish, not only where you are in Seoul, but also in the president's trips with the Japanese prime minister in Japan and also with President Xi in China?
Yes, this has been the focus of the trip, first with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in Tokyo, the same type of harsh language coming from Shinzo Abe concerning North Korea. And here in Seoul, where I've been the entire week, the president delivered a very measured but firm speech at the parliament for South Korea at the National Assembly building, where the president laid out the case for why the rest of the world needs to be unified against North Korea. And then following his about 48-hour trip here to Seoul, he traveled for 48 hours to Beijing. And there he made the case once again to Chinese President Xi Jinping that they need to do more to rein in North Korea and put an end to this nuclear crisis.
Curious, given the time that you've spent in Seoul now a few days, does the North Korea issue loom large? Is this something that you hear about when you're out on the streets?
Well, I have spent a considerable amount of time here, and I have spoken to a number of people who call Seoul, South Korea home. Just to give you a picture of what we're talking about, Seoul, South Korea, a population of 10 million, it's only 35 miles from the North Korean border. And interestingly enough, Jared, the people that live here go about their lives. This is a vibrant city, one of the most modern cities in Asia, and its economy is booming. They go about their lives. They deal with the threat posed by North Korea every day. But having said that, they also go about trying to make this city of Seoul and this country of South Korea a more vibrant place. Yes, they're concerned. Yes, they pay a lot of attention to what's happening in terms of the speeches, the rhetoric from President Donald Trump. But they also go about, as we all do, living their lives on a daily basis.
You mentioned the rhetoric of President Trump, and his remarks were pretty measured in Seoul. His tweets leading up to the trip have not always been measured, and we can remember what he said a few months ago in the UN speech that he gave. How was the president received in Seoul, not just by the president there, but by some of the folks that you've interacted with?
Well, not just the folks that I've interacted with. The main English language newspaper here in Seoul gave rave reviews to the president's speech that he delivered to Parliament just a few days ago. And they said that he said the right things. He said it in the right way. They called it, in their words, eloquent. And so the president was certainly well received here. It was the first time in decades that an American president had addressed the people of South Korea in the manner that he did at their Parliament building. And so the president left here with, I think, even higher approval ratings than when he arrived. Having said that, the president's approval rating in all of South Korea, if you look at polls, is less than what it was under President Obama. President Obama, for whatever reason, I guess you'd have to dig down into those polls, but was received more warmly by the people of South Korea. But the president did well here. He did what he wanted to do. He accomplished what he wanted to accomplish before moving on to Beijing and trying to make the hard sell to Beijing and to President Xi to use its leverage to get North Korea and Kim Jong-un to the negotiating table, get them to give up their nuclear weapons.
Is that viewed as possible in South Korea? Do South Korean leaders expect in short order to be sitting down with their North Korean counterparts and working out some sort of denuclearization deal?
That's the hope. That's the hope. Having said that, you know, I think the reality is for a lot of them that they fear that it won't be this peaceful transition. We know that over the course of the past year, Kim Jong-un has tested the region, has tested the world community with his firing of ballistic missiles, his testing of nuclear weapons. And so the fear is that what will bring them to the negotiating table will be some sort of conflict leading up to that. And that's unfortunate if that indeed is the case.
And that's what sort of is the underlining threat here is by all measures, by all accounts of the intelligence community, Kim Jong-un, the North Korean regime, is making rapid progress on not only their nuclear program, but their intercontinental missile program, a delivery system, if you will, for these nuclear weapons.
Exactly. And that's why the president is making the push to each of these Asian leaders to do more because, you know, according to the White House, according to H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, time is running out in terms of dealing with the North Korean problem. So the president, his big ask, I don't think he's going to be successful in this, but his big ask of President Xi is to cut off all crude oil to North Korea. I think that that would just devastate the country and would create some chaos, perhaps, even if that were to occur with the economy crumbling.
President Trump was unable to make an unannounced, it was going to be a surprise trip to the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, bad weather prohibiting his helicopter from landing. You, however, John, did get to make that trip. I'm interested to hear about what most of us would consider a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Yeah, it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, that's for sure, Jared. And I think that President Trump, when he completes his 12-day trip to Asia, I think one of his biggest regrets will be that he didn't make it to the DMZ, because it is just fascinating there. The Korean War ended in 1953, and decades later, there's still this demilitarized zone. Military officials that were with me describe it as the most militarized, demilitarized zone in the entire world. And you get a sense about the tension that exists there on a daily basis, 24/7, 365. You essentially have North Korean soldiers staring down American and ROK, Republic of Korea soldiers, just yards from one another. And it's scary. It's scary that this is happening in 2017. And it's scary that, you know, you have 1,500 pieces of artillery pointed right here where I am in Seoul, ready to go off at a moment's notice.
John, I know you're headed back to the States. Safe travels, get some rest, and thanks for joining us and for all the fine reporting during the president's trip to Asia. While President Trump was abroad, Republicans in Congress made some progress on the administration's current top domestic agenda item, a tax bill designed to lower what most people pay and simplify the tax code. Democrats complain rich people and corporations will get most of those breaks. Both the House and Senate are now working on separate bills, making tweaks as they go. Our senior Capitol Hill correspondent, Chad Pergram, covered it with me this week.
Big headline for tax reform is the first hurdle has been cleared for House Republicans. They got a bill, a tax bill, a little bit different than the one introduced last week. Some changes, we'll talk about it, but got it through the House Ways and Means Committee. All the Republicans voted for it. That was a strong sign for Republicans.
That wasn't a surprise that all of them would vote for it. I mean, you had people like Lynn Jenkins, who's a Republican from Kansas, who voted against the budget resolution, but she was going to vote for this in committee. And again, you know, it was the degree of emphasis that you saw from Democrats opposed to this. Bill Pascrell is a Democrat from New Jersey. New Jersey is a high tax state, presumably will get hit hard by this tax bill because they curb a little bit on the state and local tax deductions, but not enough, certainly for Democrats, and maybe not enough for some Republicans. But when he cast his ballot, they called his name on the roll, and he said, New Jersey votes no. And then they went to another high tax state, California. And Linda Sanchez, who's a Democrat from California, when they called her name, she said, hell no. So that kind of tells you where some people think about this bill, at least on the Democratic side of the aisle.
There were 4 days of debate, amendment debate within the Ways and Means Committee and what's called a markup process. But then it all sort of comes to its end on the last day with a brand new bill, essentially a manager's amendment, as they call it, which comes from the chairman, Kevin Brady, in this case. And it made some changes that a lot of social conservatives had been asking for, some business groups as well. Notably, the original bill that came out last week had a lot of deductions that you could no longer take. You couldn't count these deductions anymore, including one for adoption. Pro-life movement put up quite some opposition to that. That's back into the House bill.
Right. And there's also a provision that deals with churches. You know, churches are tax exempt. And it basically said you can wade into political speech so long as it's in the normal course of worship from the pulpit or normal church activities. Now, one can debate what a normal church activity is. But you can maintain your status tax exempt and basically, you know, do politics from the pulpit.
They did not make many changes, though, to some of the issues that you brought up with SALT. SALT deductions are still largely out of this House bill. No tax deduction for your state income taxes, and the property taxes are capped at a lower level than they're capped at under current law, right?
Right, and that's going to be the thing to get the New Jersey and the New York members on board. I talked to one senior Republican source who basically said under, you know, not mincing any words about this, that the California folks, some of the California folks were in play. There was so much time that was spent on the New Jersey and New York folks. If you have to deal with the other group now, you know, you can see where as you get closer to trying to vote on this in the next few days, that problems keep popping up. Luke Messer is a Republican from Indiana. He'll probably vote for this. But he said it's kind of like Jackie Chan, only he can fight 1,000 people at once and still win in the movies. You can't do that in Congress.
So as the House Ways and Means Committee, and by the way, there's going to be a vote, we expect, towards the end of next week on this House bill. So the House may pass a tax reform bill by the end of next week.
Correct. And you could have changes. The gateway to the House floor is the Rules Committee.
As the House Ways and Means Committee was wrapping up the House tax bill, the Senate Republicans were unveiling their tax bill. We have talked about how the House and Senate have been working together under this shared framework that they put together with the White House, sort of broad stroke principles that they want a final tax bill to look like. But it doesn't get into the finer details. And that's where we see some pretty significant policy differences in what the House is putting forward and what the Senate is putting forward. And we can start, Chad, with the corporate tax rate. This 20% corporate tax rate has been as close to a red line, I think, as the White House has on any sort of tax package. It is automatic and immediate in the House bill. It is delayed for some time in the Senate bill.
Delayed by a year in the Senate, you know, whereas the House would reduce it, to 20%, and that's it right there. Another major difference are the deductions for mortgages. You know, it's $500,000 in the House of Representatives, but the Senate, the deductions for mortgages go all the way up to $1 million.
That's something those in the House side, Republicans from New York and New Jersey, would like to see.
Yes, absolutely. And another thing that's in the House bill is the so-called bubble tax, which is not in the Senate bill. In other words, if you earn $1 million, and some people call this maybe an additional bracket, you might put an asterisk next to that. If you earn $1 million, they will then tax as a surcharge at a 6% rate up to $200,000 of your next, in other words, up to $1.2 million. That's something that the Senate bill doesn't address at all. Some people describe that as another bracket. It's not really, but it does take that rate essentially from the 39.5% really up to about 45.5%. That technically is a sixth bracket, and that's something that the Senate doesn't deal with at all in that so-called bubble tax.
Neither the House nor the Senate has included a repeal of the individual mandate. This was not expected. Healthcare really wasn't expected to be an issue in the tax bill. And then within the last couple of days, I think you'd agree, Chad, this talk started to build so much so that Republican leaders, even now with both bills out, haven't ruled out the idea of maybe doing some Obamacare repeal in a tax bill.
You know how you keep your best pinch hitter on the bench, and you're waiting to bring that fella in at just the right moment. You may not need him. You may not need him, but you need to keep a right-handed bat or a left-handed bat. Well, they're keeping this bat on the bench, and I will bet dollars to donuts, if they don't have the votes on this bill when it goes to the House next week, and they go to that important meeting of the Rules Committee, which is the gateway to the House floor, and they control how much time is debated and what, if any, amendments are offered. If they're having trouble, I bet that's the pinch hitter. Now batting a repeal of the individual mandate. Individual mandate. Here's the one scenario where it could wind up in the Senate bill. They have to comply with this special set of rules of not busting the deficit, exploding the deficit. It's called budget reconciliation. It's the only way they can avoid a filibuster in the Senate, but you can't explode the deficit. And so if you want to, deal with the Obamacare repeal, that's about $338 billion of additional revenue if you repeal the individual mandate that you can bring in there. And so, again, maybe that's the pinch hitter that comes up at the right time to hit the ball out of the park.
So one box is checked on tax reform for Republicans, but as you point out, Chad, several more boxes remain on this list.
I have a little postcard here. It's kind of like what Paul Ryan rolled out, that if they pass the bill in their way, it's going to be this 15-point postcard, and you just check off which area you fall into if you don't itemize and put it in the mail. And guess what? You don't have to go to your accountant. You don't have to sit there with your green eye shades all night long and figure out things on April 14th. So one box is now checked. You're absolutely right. The Ways and Means Committee has reported out a tax reform bill.
And we will wait and see what happens next. As always, Chad, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Did you vote on Tuesday? There were state and local elections across the country, and in several of those races, Democrats made some big gains, especially in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Should Republicans worry about the results? Should Democrats expect a wave next year? We thought it was a good time to bring back Kyle Condick in, the managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. you know, a lot of people are looking at these races on Tuesday and saying, listen, Democrats win in Virginia, Democrats win in New Jersey. It's not that surprising. It's not a telltale sign of some sort of Democratic wave next year. What was your take as you saw these results start to come in?
I thought the Democratic performance was pretty impressive, particularly in Virginia. Ralph Northam outran the polls. He did better than Hillary Clinton did in the state by a few points. And I think what was most telling was the really sizable Democratic gains in the House of Delegates, the lower house of the state legislature. Democrats or Republicans went into Tuesday night with a 66-34 advantage. It looks like at best the Republican advantage is going to be 51-49, and it remains possible that the Democrats could get to a tie or even a majority of their own. A handful of the races are so close that they're probably going to end up being recounts. And that was surprising because we all thought the Democrats would add seats, but, you know, somewhere around 10 seemed like basically the highest plausible, and they ended up getting to at least 15. And now, granted, all of those or almost all of those gains were in seats that Hillary Clinton won in the last presidential race. But there are also districts that Republicans drew several cycles ago, not thinking that they would ever be truly threatened. And not only did they win all these seats, but they also defeated a ton of Republican incumbents. And so I think that is a, you know, potentially alarming to some Republicans sitting in Clinton districts across the country, be it in the U.S. House or in state legislatures across the country. You know, the Republican margins that Trump won did hold up for the most part out in the rural Appalachian part of Virginia. And so that's potentially promising for Republicans that, you know, the Democratic gains are mostly in sort of blue or swing areas. But look, I mean, the results were not that surprising in the sense that when a party wins the White House, they generally struggle in off-year elections, particularly if the president is unpopular. And the president is unpopular. And you know, what we saw in Virginia is sort of what sometimes happens. But we're also a long way away from the 2018 midterm. And so, you know, I wouldn't draw any broad sweeping conclusions.
About the unpopularity of the president, is that what you attribute Virginia to? Or is it that in sort of maybe a higher enthusiasm, an enthusiasm gap, Democrats, progressive Democrats who still feel burned from the election last year coming out in numbers that would be unusual in a off-year election like they do in Virginia?
Yeah, turnout was really decent on both sides, just to sort of put it in perspective. And it's not quite an apples-to-apples comparison because there was a significant third-party candidate in 2013's governor's race in Virginia. But Ed Gillespie, the Republican gubernatorial candidate, actually won about 160,000 more raw votes in Virginia than Cuccinelli did four years ago. But Ralph Northam won about 335,000 more votes than outgoing Governor Terry McAuliffe did 4 years ago. And so you could see that, you know, Virginia is a growing state, so the electorate's going to increase in size anyway. But you could see that, you know, Gillespie did better than Cuccinelli did, but Northam did even better than that compared to McAuliffe's performance from 4 years ago. So I do think that this was a Democratic surge sort of turnout for an off-year election.
And we've seen that not just in Virginia this week, but across the country in really local races where it seems like even in some school board races, I think, you know, mailers and things really nationalized these issues. I know the old saying, all politics is local, but it seems like these local politics are taking a national tone.
Yeah, I think our politics are about as nationalized as they've ever been, or at least in recent years they've ever been. And you do see, I think, that the people's feelings about the president kind of help set the turnout. And if the president's party, the president's unpopular, if they're sort of unhappy, the turnout can sag a little bit. The other side is sort of angry and fired up. And, you know, as we saw during the Obama years, I think anger at the president was a great motivator for, you know, the Tea Party and Republicans.
As you look at the raw data, some of the exit polling, some of the analysis done now over the last few days, do you get a sense that either the House, the Senate, or both are in play in 2018?
Oh, the House is definitely going to be in play. And that doesn't mean, you know, there's some sort of certainty that Democrats will win it or something. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the Democrats will have a shot to win the House, even though the House playing field sort of tilts Republican. Just to sort of put that in perspective, the median House district, so the one that is both the 435 House seats, The one that is both the 218th most Democratic and 218th most Republican based on the 2016 presidential results is the district held by Republican Scott Taylor, who's a representative from the Hampton Roads area in Virginia. Trump won that district by about 3.5 points. Remember, he lost the national popular vote by 2. So that district is 5.5 points more Republican than the national average, and that's the median district. So that sort of illustrates that there is a Republican tilt to the House map right now. And, you know, one potentially promising sign for Democrats is that that district I mentioned, Scott Taylor of Virginia 2, Ralph Northam, the Democratic governor-elect in Virginia, did carry that district, even though Trump carried it last year.
Kyle Condick, we'll talk again before the votes are cast again. Thanks so much.
Sounds good. Thank you.
One more note. Kyle made the point that a lot can still happen between now and next year's midterm elections. In fact, as we were conducting our interview, news of the Washington Post story about Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore was just starting to spread. Moore, a conservative Republican who upset sitting Republican Senator Luther Strange in a GOP primary earlier this year, is accused of sexual contact with a 14-year-old girl when he was a 32-year-old assistant district attorney nearly 40 years ago. Moore strongly denies the allegations, but several Republican senators say if it's true, Moore should step away from the race. Even before the Washington Post report, this race was unexpectedly close. A Fox News poll last month showed Moore tied with Democrat Doug Jones in a state President Trump won by more than 27 points. That will do it from the From Washington podcast this week. Can House Republicans get a tax bill to the end zone? That's their goal next week, and we will have all the play-by-play. And Senator Rand Paul, who allegedly got beat up by a neighbor while mowing his lawn, is due back in the Senate. We may get some answers about what happened. If you enjoy this From Washington podcast, then you will love the Fox News Rundown, our new daily podcast, analysis and insight on the day's biggest stories straight to your phone every morning. For an edgier take on the news, check out the Whip Around podcast with John Saucier. You can subscribe to all of our Fox News radio podcasts on Apple or wherever you search for new audio content. And as always, stay up on the very latest with your Fox News radio affiliate and our social media pages on Twitter and Facebook. For all of us at Fox News Radio, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.